takes a minute or a second or two here to run up. Okay, I think we're probably back on here.
Okay, so I kind of went beyond maybe the scope of your original question.
No, I'm glad to find out I didn't know about it.
But there were any number of problems that, of course, came out of the early engine firings, which caused either modification of hardware which had been released in the system, or and certainly got cranked into the next batch of hardware that was going, design that was going to be released in the system.
Could you pick out a problem that you remember, especially that developed during the test and qualification program that brought about a redesign of hardware?
We had lots of them. I don't know if there's any one particular one to emphasize.
We read the NASA press releases and the AIAA presentations by Rocketdyne people, which isn't to say anything against them, you know, but you get the impression that this was a beautiful program. You know, there must have been a problem somewhere.
Well, I guess this is a matter of debate. I don't know, my own personal philosophy is that you have a development program is to find out what's wrong mm-hmm. with things and correct it. In other words, I think it's more accurate to say that happiness should be finding a failure and not, rather than not finding mm-hmm. failure, because if you don't find it, then you're going to be hung up sometime in a critical mission or flight mm-hmm. or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. So the J2 program did find lots of failures and had to correct them during the program. The most difficult part of it came into play when we had to release engines for production, and we had engines in the production pipeline, and we were still finding failures. And it's particularly difficult because then it means that a solution has to be found that you can crank into the production line and fix that particular piece of production hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Not only before it's delivered from the line, but we had cases where engines had already been delivered to the field that we had to send out modification kits to fix them. And a lot of people look at this as saying, well, gee, why didn't you find all those things before you send those engines out to production? Well, truth of the matter is that the program always needs the production hardware before it's fully developed.
For schedules? To meet your schedules?
Schedules. And so we have not only on the Saturn program, but on every program in the missile rocket business that I ever looked at, including the Air Force programs, we had a situation of what we call concurrent development and production.
Right.
General Schriever recognized that during the early IBM days. We certainly had it during the Saturn Apollo. The engine being the long tent, one of the long lead items for the entire system, suffers particularly because the vehicle people would like to get an operational engine cranked in their vehicle as soon as possible. Many times they'd like to have it, rather than waiting to have it at some point where you install the engine down at the Cape before you launch it, they're not satisfied with that usually. They usually want to crank the engine in the early part of the vehicle build-up cycle, back at the vehicle manufacturing area,
mm-hmm.
so that the whole system, engine, vehicle, everything goes through the system checkouts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sometime in the future we can promote a philosophy to give us more time in the engine area, where we can then install the engines at the other end of the line. which doesn't mean as much as maybe a year of extra development and maturity.
Can you give an example? Do you remember what kind of modifications kits you were sending out? I mean,
yeah. Let me give an example that hit us in the production line before we're just beginning to deliver some of the first. We were about ready to deliver the first flight engine for Saturn 1B, which was going to Douglas, engine number 15, 2015, I believe. And this line was in the stages of final. Engine was in stages of final assembly when we discovered that we had a burned out a section of the gas generator wall, actually put a hole in it. In fact, I believe this happened on one of the battleship engines that we had sent to Douglas, Sacramento. And it happened on another engine or two that were being was firing San Susana.
Mm-hmm.
This launched an intensive development effort to solve this problem, in which Rocketdyne came up with a change to the throat of the gas generator that they call candid choke ring, which diverted the gases somewhat so they didn't impinge on the wall. So this candid choke ring then had to be worked into all the gas generators that were on the line. It meant actually cutting the gas generator, which was welded to the fuel turbine manifold,
yeah.
So taking this assembly off, reworking, and then rewelding everything back up again. So it was quite a rework and turnaround problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a modification that could be incorporated into existing hardware to solve the problem. So that's an example of a problem that hit us during the manufacturing cycle. One of the most serious development problems, I think, in terms of seriousness that we found was the fact that we had some very definite problems in the engine start sequence. During an attempted semi-qualification, which we call PFRT testing, we did discover that we did have a control problem or sequencing problem in the start buildup, which actually caused the LOX valve to be forced closed such the LOX valve had such hydraulic pressure against it it wouldn't open properly. And this caused an excessive back pressure. Since the gas generator was tapped off above the LOX valve, the gas generator LOX balance went LOX rich. We got too hot of temperatures and burned out the turbine, a few other things. So this did point out the fact we had a problem there. We'd also been having problems in starting the engine due to hydrogen pump stall, in which case the power balance was very sensitive between the LOX and fuel turbine speed buildups, and if the pressure in the chamber built up too fast, then because the LOX pump was putting more LOX in the main thrust chamber, causing the pressure main thrust chamber pressure to build up too fast, this caused excessive back pressure on the hydrogen side, and it got ahead, you might say, of the hydrogen pump buildup, and we had a condition which forced the operating curve of the pump, which pushed it over into the stall region, the pump, and the pump would stop pumping. So that was called hydrogen stall. So there was extensive development effort launched to find improvements and to the start sequence, which necessitated running a much larger number of engine system tests than we had originally planned. Because the only way you could work on this problem was to run the engine system.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem I mentioned, when we burned out the gas generator, we solved a problem in the pit, effectively, in the gas generator pit. But in this case, there was no other way to solve the problem except to make many cut and try, as you will, at the engine test itself. Rocketdyne used all of their analytical methods and the start computer, which they had developed and so forth, and tried to make refinements on that computer in order to get a better handle on things. So they used all the techniques that they could. But really what it came down to is that you had to make it an adjustment and then try it. Also, Also, the final solution had to be tested under altitude conditions to make sure that it was also valid because of the altitude affecting the start.
Okay, that's very good. A good example, I think, you know, what happened, what you have to do to change it. Another brief question here, and I'm taking enough of your time, I think. The J-2 was built for a mission of around 500 seconds, but the lifetime was about 3,750 seconds, or around that area.
Yes, 3,750 was the qualification life.
Okay, now why the difference? What were you doing inside those 3,750 seconds that you needed that many of when the actual mission was only 500?
Well, I guess it's a philosophical sort of a question. It gets back down to some basic assumptions. And number one is the fact that I guess when an engine is delivered to the Cape for flight, it's already going to have a certain amount of time on it. It's not going to be zero time. So there's about 750 seconds allocated for the acceptance test of the engine. And then there was another 500 seconds allocated for the vehicle ground test. In other words, they did fire the S2 stages and the S4B stages on the ground for quite a while. In fact, I guess they fired all of the S2 stages ground. But then as a reserve, there was additional time allocated beyond that. In other words, suppose you have a vehicle problem or a reason to refire the vehicle for some reason on the ground, you might have to run another complete test. So you can rationalize yourself that you might have engines at least 1,500 seconds that would still have to be qualified for flight. Now, as it turns out, most of them didn't have that much time on them when they got to the Cape. More like maybe 1,500 to 2,000 seconds. You could rationalize you might be in that range, but most of them were in the 1,000 to 1,200 range that actually turned out. All right. So then beyond that, you say, well, why would you need any more time? And this is strictly a matter of judgment in the fact that trying to make a maturity or reliability type assessment, I think the goal of 3750 was chosen because it would also increase the confidence level upon which the engine, say, of some lesser time would have during flight.
Is this part of the man reading philosophy too?
Yes. It was at least in our minds at that time. The fact that we were going to fly a man, and we previously qualified engines at much less time, and we felt that that 3,750 seconds was perhaps not an unreasonable amount of time at all for a hydrogen type of an engine. Now, I can't say that this is any magic number for manned spaceflight, because it wasn't. Mm-hmm. The F1 had a qualification time of 2,250 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And which was felt reasonable for the conditions that you'd expect with a LOX RP type engine. In other words, the fuel made a considerable difference because there were more effects on the F1 life by using RP fuel because of coking, carbon deposits, and other types of problems that you've got with the fuel. Hydrogen engine, everything stays brand shiny clean. Don't have those kind of problems, and you can expect a longer life inherently from a hydrogen engine. So this was one reason why, you might say, somewhat arbitrarily, 3750 was chosen to be, you know, at least some measure beyond what we have done in the LOX RP type engines. And so that's about it. There are probably some other philosophical reasons that you might get from some other people. I don't know.
Well, do you have any, you know, things that you'd like to say?
Kind of, well, just to make one more little sidelight on this whole thing. In fact, I don't know when the designer designer looks at 3,750 seconds, whether he designed the bearing carrier much different than whether it was 3,000 or 2,000 or what. But we actually ran some R&D engines with, of course, some component replacement here and there, but we had components on R&D engines which had gone well over up to 20,000 seconds. And we had several other samples at 10,000, 15,000, that range.
Gives you a pretty high confidence factor, would seem to me.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, it's because of this kind of data that we feel rather confident that space shuttle main engine, we can eventually attain the 7.5 hour life of 100 mission requirements.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we don't even know today that some of the J2 components wouldn't have gone much beyond the 20,000 seconds because we just gave up at that point. Some of them were even worn out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we had to today take a J2 engine and make it a reusable type of engine to go to a long life. Many missions. We have some data which there will be some areas in the J2 that we know are life limited, which would have to be redesigned. But from a general standpoint, it did give us high confidence of the J2 from the J2 data that many of the hydrogen type components would run considerably longer than what we had ever tested.
Well, I've taken a good share of your time here.
Well, I understood about an hour. Is there anything else you have on your list that you want to go into?
No, some of the there are questions that I've picked up just in reading, odds and ends of things. One thing that's really a stupid question, but what does J2 mean?
Doesn't mean anything particularly. Rocketdyne had a system of numbering there. Their engines. Well, maybe it's a lack of system. But we had I can't really say where it started. We had Rocketdyne had an E1 experimental engine program. They had the F1 program, and. Seemed to me there was a D program somewhere that didn't live very long, and I don't know what happened to some of the other numbers in between. They probably died in the proposal mill somewhere, but there was an H1, of course, which was picked on the H1, and I think they skipped I for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
The next thing that came out of the bag after the H1 was the J1.
J1.
Yeah. And Rocketdyne peddled this around the country in the advanced design sales department, I'd say, for a while.
Was it a hydrogen engine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was an advanced design concept, really.
Uh-huh.
They called it J1. And then when NASA got serious about going into a development of a hydrogen type engine of the 200,000-pound class, then to distinguish from the version that they had been peddling around the country, they called it the J2. I guess basically, I don't even think J2 appeared in their proposal. Mm-hmm. But when they got down to negotiating the contract, they said, "Well, we're going to call this the J2 since we had a J1. Did anybody object?" And, NASA didn't have any numbering system established for engines like the Air Force had their XLR type series. We didn't have any official numbering system, so we said we don't know that makes any difference. It's called the J2. Of course, we already had the H1 being one, and the F1 program had already been started, and so it seemed kind of logical to us to call it J2.
While you were out there, do you remember any incidents that struck you, or you remember as being humorous or funny? people out there who are really strong characters? Little anecdotes about any of them?
I probably could if I thought about it a little bit. After all those years, we haven't... we certainly must have... We certainly had a lot of interesting meetings. It got pretty wild at times, but... let me think a minute. Well, I really can't remember anything offhand. As I say, sure, I'm sure I would if I thought about it a bit.
What about Von Braun?
Well, he used to come out quite often to the West Coast and visit the Rocketdyne and review the program. Attended many of our review meetings that we had in the early days. And later on, he got demands were heavier on his time. He came out less often, but he usually managed to come out once a year and review all of the activities at Rocketdyne.
Did you find those helpful necessarily, or was it something you did because it was for, you know, his primary information and benefit?
No, I wouldn't say. Obviously, I think that it was not only a general feeling by the NASA people, but I think the contractor too appreciated the opportunity to bring the center director, Von Braun, of course, being the center director at that time, up to date on what was going on. And I think this helped the morale a lot, because you did feel that the top management was interested in the effort. And not only that, I think that Von Braun himself was quite an inspiration to the program and any meetings that he attended, because his comments and observations were, I would say, very, very helpful, because it put what we were doing in you know, one detailed part of the Saturn, Apollo, and the whole system somewhat in more context as to really what our objective was.
Mm-hmm.
That was helpful. In fact, I think those type of reviews and those type of meetings perhaps gave us more insight on where we really should be going than probably some of the day-to-day directives that we used to get.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too easy to put the director in file 13 down there, I suppose, too.
Because, my only general comment on the whole thing, I thought it was a very, very interesting program, and I think that I certainly learned a lot from the program. In fact, much of what we learned from the program, we will attempt to apply in general to our management of future programs. In other words, not just learning what to do, but certainly a few things that we learn now. I hope, perhaps, not to do in a future program of this type. And one thing I think that we learned, I think this might be specifically of interest, that in looking back over the J2 program history, and we've done a lot of this in the last couple of years, going back into our history and deciding how we might possibly improve the approach, the management, that is a development approach and management. This is even over and above the technical things that, you know, obviously going to go into our new program. But we're trying to apply this to our management approach now, the take on the shuttle engines. And just for an example of this, I think we learned in looking over the J2 program that we need to have more emphasis on the component and subsystems testing. And also we learned that we need to get in earlier to testing the limits of the hardware. We did J2. example, we had run the hydrogen turbopump a number of months at some fairly nominal type of conditions. And they're within specifications, so to speak. Performance was fine, no problems. Well, I won't say no problems, but the thing seemed to perform the way it should, basically. When they started to run what you might call higher limits to higher power levels, higher speeds, and things of this sort that might be on the outer fringes of the operational environment. In other words, the engine probably wouldn't run there except maybe under some unusual conditions or what have you. We failed turbine wheel, and found we got into a serious vibration problem with the turbine wheel, what they called a non-synchronous whirl, if that means anything.
A non-synchronous whirl.
That's right. But it was a critical vibration problem that at certain speed, the turbine wouldn't stand up and developed a fatigue crack and came apart. So, unfortunately, that caused us then to put some limits on the production hardware, in the sense that we had to inspect turbine wheels out in the field for a certain number of engines until we got to the production model that had the new turbine wheel in it. And people look back on that and say, now had we the first couple of weeks we were running that turbo pump, taking that machine up to that condition, we would have found the problem sufficiently early to prevent any impact at all to the program.
Mm-hmm.
So this might sound a little critical of some of the things we did in the program. It doesn't bother me to talk about it because I think that a development program is a learning process all in itself, and nobody can be 100% smart in developing something that's completely unknown,
mm-hmm.
or that you just can't predict everything. So so these types of things will, I think, make us a little smarter going into the new programs. On the other hand, there are probably some things about the new high-pressure designs that we think we understand today, but we'll come crawling out of the woodwork at it.
Yeah.
So,
Well, I better turn this off and let you get at the worms coming out of the woodwork.